From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made 8 days ago, last Monday night, at Jiva Theater. For years, the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation has undertaken a project, an effort to highlight businesses that are behaving ethically. They call the awards the Ethies. They employ actual judges, and the process is not a quick one. Well, this year, 7 companies and organizations were chosen as finalists for the Ethies. 2 were selected as recipients. And the reasons for the selection of finalists always vary. To my eye, it's always interesting to try to understand what makes for ethical behavior in businesses and companies. Yeah, especially in the business realm. I mean, we could talk ethics all day here, but we're talking in the business realm today, and it's a particularly timely conversation, given the consistent debate about capitalism on the national level. One of the leading Democrats, Senator Bernie Sanders, leveled an attack against Senator Elizabeth Warren just this past weekend. In an interview on ABC's This Week, Sanders explained, quote, "There are differences between Elizabeth and myself. She has said that she is a capitalist through her bones. I'm not," end quote. Sanders does not believe American enterprise can behave ethically enough to create a fair and just society. Warren does. This hour, a conversation about ethics and business, and our guests this hour include 2 representatives of recipient organizations of the Ethies this year. And they include David Pritchard, who is the president of Gore Bell, Inc. Congratulations and welcome, David. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
And also with us is Stephen Schwarz, who's managing partner of Farachi Lang. Welcome and congratulations to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for having us.
Also here is Bob Whipple, who's a member of the board of the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation. He's known around town as the Trust Ambassador. He's the CEO of Leader Grow, Inc. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
And also with us is Dr. Ray Shady, who's a member of the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation Board, former dean of the business school at St. John Fisher College, and someone who has spent his career in business marketing. Ray, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
So there are 7 finalists, and I know, Bob, you're always careful to say, you know, and you cautioned me before the program began here. You really view the 7 finalists as winners. There are 2 recipient organizations.
Fair enough? That's right.
Fair enough?
They're all winners. If they can reach that standard as being a finalist in our competition, they've gone through some pretty rigorous analysis and convinced 2 groups of judges, one independent paper exam and then the other one a site visit, that they're top-notch ethical organizations. So they're all winners.
But let me ask both the board members here, and then we're going to talk to the representatives from 2 of the recipient organizations, what ethics means. But when you say, well, they're an ethical organization, they're an ethical company, they behave ethically, mm-hmm. Are we talking to employees? Are we talking to shareholders? Are we talking to clients and customers? I mean, this is going to be a different answer, and it's a sort of a subjective one.
No, it's to all stakeholders. The idea is they need to show that they have a values-based approach to running an enterprise that is more than just lip service. A lot of organizations have values on the walls, but they aren't really practicing it on a daily basis, and it doesn't come up in the conversation every day. These companies that are finalists or recipients live and breathe the ethics such that people in the organization, customers, partners, other stakeholders, mm-hmm. even shareholders, recognize that that's their culture and that they live that way every day.
And Ray, throughout the process of judging, the goal is to really examine that, because my guess is most businesses will tell you, oh, yeah, we behave ethically. Sure, we do. You've got to find a rigorous way to figure that out, I guess, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. And it serves no one if you reach out to the world to make it better but mistreat your own employees. So there has to be all stakeholders addressed with a culture of ethical behavior.
How do you define ethics? If someone says, "Oh, you're on the board of RABEF here," so what does it mean for a business to behave ethically in 2019?
Well, I don't have a rehearsed answer. The simple one would be, just to do the right thing. That's oversimplistic, but ethics implies a code of behavior, not just random good works. It means this is what we do as an organization, this is what I do as a leader of a company, and this is what my company means to society.
Hmm. Well, Stephen, I'll tell you that my father, before his retirement, was a partner in a law firm for about 40 years, told me when I was a little guy, he said, you're going to hear a lot of jokes about lawyers in your life, and most of them are deserved. But my dad always said, some of the best people you'll meet are lawyers, and maybe some of the worst, but really many of the best people are doing it for reasons that go beyond the cliches and the jokes. So take the jokes, laugh at them, know that we've earned them to some degree, but we can do better than that. My dad always told me that from the time I was a young man, and I thought that was interesting. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what Faraci Lang has been doing? Because I know that's a name the community knows, but tell us about what the firm does, and then we're going to talk about how you ended up as a recipient of this award.
Well, some 50 years ago, our founding partner, Angelo Faraci, started out as a sole practitioner, actually, doing personal injury work mainly. And I think his goal was to try to help people and use his skills to do that. And I think the firm and the business part of it sort of came along with that, and that he brought in people like myself and others who believed, like he believed, that our primary job was to try to help people. And we were able to do that. And I guess doing things the right way was always his way. And I think that's the culture that we've developed as the years have gone on. We've gotten a lot bigger. We now have offices in both Rochester and Buffalo. But we still, I think, act just the same way as we did back in the day when Angelo first started.
When did you first start there?
I began at Faraci Lang in 1984. I had just finished a clerkship with the Honorable Michael A. Telesca in federal court. I had opportunities to work at a variety of different law firms in town. After that job, Judge Telesca being Judge Telesca and the context that he has made me very marketable at that point. But Angelo Faraci reached out to me, and it was the kind of work I always wanted to do, and I've never regretted it.
So I hope you can laugh with us when I say, well, the ethics started with a car dealership, and now you've got personal injury lawyers, so you've really come full circle. Congratulations, Bob.
And even a government group.
We can laugh about that because of the stereotypes. So let me ask you then, let's get more specific. You know, Steve, when we think about why the public might, you know, have certain ideas about injury firms, what do you think is unethical behavior, or what do you think are some of the common pitfalls that you have to try to avoid if you're intentional about it?
Well, I think that there are a variety of things that the public kind of rightfully has pointed to some law firms as being inappropriate. One of them would be, chasing down clients who have been involved in accidents and bothering them at times in their life that they should never be bothered by lawyers. There's always time to bring lawsuits. It's not an immediate thing. And that concept is just so antithetical to both ethics and to the way we practice that we can't even believe it goes on. But we do hear that it does go on. We hear from people that they're contacted by lawyers asking them for that. The other thing I think that's really important is the concept of believing in your cases and not trying to use the legal system as some sort of extortion tool to get settlements out of companies to avoid litigation. You know, we've always prided ourselves in never taking a case that we didn't believe in and that we didn't think was successful, and never trying to just bring a case for purposes of trying to get a settlement out of a company to avoid the expense of going through a case. So you develop, I think, a reputation for that. And as a result, and I think that that's an important part, and I think you brought it up on Monday night at the award ceremony, that, you know, ethics doesn't have to be a sort of a negative or a detriment to competition. In fact, a lot of us believe that by performing and acting ethically, we can be very successful in business. So we're very thankful that there are organizations in town like this that are trying to promote and highlight that people can be successful by doing the right thing.
Have there been times where you have declined to take a case because, as you say, you don't want to pursue it just for the sake of trying to shake money out of the system, that if you don't think it's the right case, you won't pursue it, and then you see that potential client go elsewhere? Has that happened?
Oh, it happens all the time. I mean, I think that we've, in certain areas of our practice, we probably turn down 95% of the cases that are referred into us for one reason or another because we don't think they can be successful. Sometimes, people have genuine grievances, but we just can't, connect the dots in a way that we think we can prove it. And then we've seen them, sometimes they are potentially successful, a lot of times they're not, but there are other lawyers that will take those cases that we just refuse to pursue.
What do you think the public maybe ought to know about your chosen profession and the way you're doing things when you think about the actual idea of helping people? Because you referenced that, you referenced it last Monday night. You talked about the idea of founding this line of work, as Angelo did, for the idea of helping people first, not helping build a law firm of wealthy attorneys. It's helping people first. What do you want the public to know about what that actually means?
Well, I think that above and beyond everything that we've gained in economic wealth, the ability to change somebody's life that has had a really bad thing happen to them and to make their life better is by far the greatest reward that we get out of our work. Now, of course, we have to keep the lights on and we have to, you know, pay the salaries of everyone. But at the end of the day, the most important thing is the number of people that I can look back on and say that our work has made a difference for them. And so when you build your firm around that kind of strategy, I think, and I guess we're fortunate that we've been good enough to make a living at the same time. But by far, and I think the people that have succeeded at our firm are always people that put that as their number one accomplishment, not necessarily how much money they brought in the door.
Well, and I don't mean to be Pollyanna here. I mean, I certainly understand that there's going to be disputes about an incident, something that might have led to an incident, culpability, et cetera. And those kind of disputes might need to go to court at times. But if we were to build a society where the likes of your kinds of firms are less needed, in other words, people who are really hurting and feel like they're going to be denied what is probably owed to them, that's going to happen less often. What would it take to create a system where people who are really kind of on the edge of not only maybe injury, but catastrophic loss, injustice, loss of future opportunity, that it will require fewer firms to kind of to go to bat for them?
That's a tough question. I think that, any particular lawsuit, and especially ones that go to trial, have issues on both sides. And I think, again, society and our justice system, our civil justice system in particular, gives juries the opportunity to decide what's reasonable and what's not. And that's not a fixed point. It's an evolving point over time. Just like the law evolves in many other areas, it evolves in that area. So the six jurors of their peers are going to decide whether the conduct was reasonable or not. If somebody runs a red light and injures somebody, it's pretty black and white that person is responsible or should be responsible for whatever those injuries are. But there are other instances that are not as clear and that they need a lot of work to figure out exactly what the standards are. We're living in a very complex society now, and it's not easy to determine, what a particular business practice should be, what a particular engineering design should be. That takes a lot of work and research and experts to look at. So I think in a utopian society, it would be, it would be great if whenever someone, because of someone else's negligence, is injured, that there was an automatic payment system that didn't require the back and forth of the legal system. But I think for many years, the back and forth of the legal system has come out with a pretty good answer in most cases, not all, it's not 100%. And I don't think it's easily replaceable because the complexities involved are just too great to put together a matrix to come up with answers to those questions.
Yeah, I was a camp counselor in my younger days, and the stories were legion about what used to be allowed at the camp. I mean, some of it was quite feral activity, and I understand why it's not done anymore. But then there were the kinds of games and activities that there always seemed to be an annual review of what was safe enough. And our European friends who had come over to work with us would routinely say things like, boy, you can get sued for anything over here. You're not allowed to do anything. You're not allowed to even play games with the kids anymore over here. And the joke is, not even a joke, it's sort of the criticism is that we are too litigious of a society. Do you think there's a balance? Is there a good balance to be struck? And do you feel like you're part of the right kind of balance at Farachi Lang?
Well, I think that it has to be a balance. And there's times that, that the pendulum can swing too far the other way. And I think that's, again, where society comes in. And, mm-hmm. and jurors can provide the balance there. And interestingly, again, I try a lot of cases. I pick a lot of juries and I talk to jurors. And there's a lot of jurors that feel exactly the same way, that say that it's an over-litigious society. So in some sense, the pendulum has swung the other way. Jurors are very skeptical today of cases involving claims that people were injured as a result of someone's negligence. And it's actually a higher bar, I think, now than it was when I first started because of that that consciousness. So I think, again, we have to trust in the system. I think in most cases, again, when we have very legitimate claims, we're gonna be successful more times than not with juries. And I think when people bring claims that are what are considered by many frivolous, if the judge doesn't dismiss them, the jury is going to beat them anyway. So. I do think that there is a balance today. I think there, the people who have strong opinions about this, when I talk to them in jury selection, rarely have any any information to back that up other than, what they've seen on television and what they've read. But I think if you look at the averages, I think the civil justice system still works pretty well. I think it works better when lawyers believe wholeheartedly that they should follow the right, the right process. And I think, again, I think by and large, lawyers do that. But there are many, and unfortunately, sometimes they're the best known, that don't. And I think that taints the entire profession, unfortunately.
Talking to Stephen Schwarz, a managing partner of Faraci Lang, one of two 2019 recipients for the Ethi Awards, the Ethical Business Awards, handed out 8 days ago. Who nominated you? Do you know?
I don't know that, actually. I think it was, we were actually finalists last year as well, and I believe it was a winner of the Ethi Award that was actually a client of one of my partners, if I recall correctly, but I can't remember the name of that person. But it was a business that one of my partners had represented, and he had nominated us, and that's how we got into the process. And I found it, I mean, we really didn't know much about it at the time we were nominated.
You mean the process of being nominated, yeah.
We had no idea how much it involved. The written application was enormous and difficult to complete. And then we had very rigorous interviews both last time and this time. So, I just had a little anecdote is that the... All of the finalists, I believe, are deserving and I'm sure get votes from the judges. And in fact, the judge from the year before came up to me and congratulated me this year and said, boy, I was fighting for you last time, too. So I'm glad you won this time. Mm-hmm. So received the award this time. So I think it's a great honor to be a finalist. And it's really, kind of splitting hairs, I think, at the end to try to figure out who should be the recipients and who shouldn't. And everyone that is a finalist has a lot to be proud of.
Is there a bounce in the step in the office for this?
Absolutely. I think we all feel, kind of, I think that, we didn't have the culture or create the culture or follow the culture that we have because we could win an award. But it is nice to be recognized that when you have that kind of culture and you believe in doing the right thing, that there are organizations out there that want to acknowledge that. And I think it's a great feeling.
Congratulations.
Thanks so much.
Faraci Lang, one of the two recipients, and Gore Bell Inc., the other. David Pritchard is the president of Gore Bell Inc. So Gore Bell is a name that Rochesterians and listeners might know a little less of, unless you're absolutely doing the kind of work that Gore Bell is doing here. Tell us about what Gore Bell is.
Well, sure. Gore Bell is a material handling company, and it was founded in 1977 by Dave Ray. And the name of the company is interesting in the fact that the founders, mom and dad, is Gordon and Isabel. So that's how Gore Bell was named. So it's a great way to remember the founding of our company and the history behind all of that. So Gore Bell is involved in the material handling industry. So any time that a company needs to move product from point A to point B or to raise product from the floor to the ceiling and whatnot, Gore Bell is there. And Gore Bell is engaged in every industry that you can think of, whether it be lifting shingles, refrigerator doors, cement blocks, bags of dog food, aircraft engines. We have a portfolio of product that manages and provides solutions to those lifting challenges. So some of the products in our product line are workstation cranes, jib cranes, electric chain hoists. So we do provide solutions to make things much easier for people to interact within a factory setting.
Are you mostly doing, like you say, factory setting, or are you doing custom jobs? Someone says, I have to lift this massive thing. Can Gorbel help me do this?
Yes, Gorbel, we like to frame the way that we manufacture product as mass customization. So we carry no finished goods inventory, and we build everything to order. Mm. So when our dealers walk into a potential customer's site, they size up the site and truly understand what the challenge is, and then we design the solution around that.
Been out driving over massive bridges and whatnot, and when you've got a seven-year-old, he'll ask, like, well, how did they put that there? And I just generally say, you know, magic. I mean, I have no idea. And if I were repopulating the human species, we would not be doing that for many, many thousands of years. So I'm always amazed at what companies like yours are able to do. How many employees do you have
now? And I do want to say, from a point of clarity, the crane systems that we provide are typically indoors. We do have some outdoor applications, but not the large, large cranes that you would see building buildings and bridges.
Anyway. Oh, man, you could have taken credit for anything there. That was very ethical of you, David. That was very. How many employees at Gorbel?
We have just over 500 employees now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And who nominated you this time around?
That's a great question. When you asked that question to Steve, I'm not sure.
You don't know?
No.
What was the process like then, going through the ethics?
Well, it's interesting. We had known about the foundation, and we knew about the award. But it always seemed very natural to us to act in a very ethical kind of a way. So it was always on our radar that someday that we would apply and learn from the process and continue to improve from the process. So it was a very rigorous application, for sure. First the written, then we had the on-site interviews. And the one interesting thing that came up during the on-site interviews that in all of our documentation that's pervasive throughout the organization, we don't use the word ethic or ethical. We use the words integrity, so there is a nice a cross over to that word. So everything is very natural for us. So we thought it was the right time to apply, and we're super excited about being a recipient of the award. And in many ways, it's an affirmation of who we are and how we operate in business. And I think it's appropriate to share the founder's family mission. David Ray had a family mission, and it reads, we will be the best that we can be. We will contribute to society. We will assist those in need, and we'll be thankful for everything that has been bestowed upon us. So that was the founder's family mission, and certainly now Brian, our CEO, one of three sons of the Ray family, certainly integrates this family mission into everything he does within the company.
That's great stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you about the way the 500 people who work for you mm-hmm. feel about ethics. What does it mean to be ethical to employees?
For us, all of the employees, surrounds itself around the word integrity, about treating each other with respect and following up on commitments and doing the things that you say you're going to do. And one interesting dynamic that the on-site auditors were very intrigued about was our performance management system. So it's an appraisal system for all of our employees, and there's a weighting system, Evan, and 40% of that weighting is based on results, 40% is based on behavior, and 20% is based on a future orientation. So can you imagine a company as successful as we are weighting more on the behavior and future orientation thinking than results? So it is possible for an organization to act in a very ethical way and be very, very successful. So some of our foundational values that you'll see on our strategy map is integrity, and positive people in a positive environment, and that transcends down to just providing an extraordinary customer experience for all of our customers around the world. But certainly integrity and positive people in a positive environment tie back very, very clearly to ethical behavior.
I have not hosted a single conversation about the ethics over the last 5-6 years or so without some listeners asking, do you pay your employees well? Are you fair to them?
Yes, we are.
They'd be happy saying that?
Yes, they would. And, you know, sometimes it's not all about making really, really large salaries. It's about the environment and the culture upon which employees operate in. So we do have a very competitive salary structure. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that people always talk about when we speak about Gore Bell, it is about the culture. It's about how people treat each other in a very respectful kind of a way. And the and as a result of that, the collaboration amongst all team members is just so super strong. This is how we deliver great experiences for our customer. And we do it in a way that everybody is uplifting each other.
How does it feel since the awards last Monday?
Well, what a week it was. So we were at the event on Monday, and Gore Bell was lucky enough to bring 32 of our employees to the event. And then after the event and being a recipient of the award, we went to dinner. And that was our first day of strategic planning. All of our leadership throughout the organization gathers together for a week each and every year. And so Monday night we celebrated, and then Tuesday we carried that energy and just an awesome, tremendous, deep sense of pride about the affirmation about what the award meant to us. So we brought that energy and a deep sense of pride into strategic planning. And now we're going to have a rather large celebration on Friday at our site, so we can celebrate that, not only at our New York facilities, but also in Alabama and Arizona.
Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know it means a lot. Gore Bell, Farachi Lang, the two recipients out of seven finalists for the 2019 Ethi Awards. Those are the Ethical Business Awards, an award ceremony put on by the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation. And the awards were 8 nights ago at Jiva Theater, where the annual award show is. And so before we shift to more general conversation on business ethics in our second half hour, and we'll invite listener feedback if you want to go ahead and join us here, I want to ask Bob and Ray from the RABEF board if you want to let listeners know about nominating them, because these guys don't know who nominated them, but anyone can join in the nominating. Yes, Bob?
Yes, you can self-nominate. A lot of organizations do that.
Is that ethical to do that?
I don't think it's a problem. I really don't think it's a problem, because the process will shake out folks that don't walk the talk. But you can self-nominate. Most don't. We are constantly on the prowl, if you will, trying to identify organizations who are really doing great things. And you'd be surprised. There's a whole lot of organizations that really don't know much about this yet. And so we're continually trying to uncover them and encourage them by nominating them to do that. Let me tell you something about Gore Bell that you probably don't know. At our nation's capital, in the Capitol building, they fly American flags over the Capitol. And those flags are rotated so that they then they give the flags to veterans and you know, people on certain milestones. They bring them up in pallets, and they're hoisted up above the Capitol building by a Gore Bell crane.
A Gore Bell crane. That's good stuff.
A White House painted white jib crane every day lifts pallets of flags to fly over the U.S. Capitol.
Well, there's something that happens outside. There you go.
That's right.
Great story. Yeah, go ahead, Ray.
One specific item in terms of nomination.
Yeah.
We have two information breakfasts coming up in the new year, and we'll formalize this. They're both at St. John Fisher location, TBD, but one is February 7th and one is March 6th. And those are always very well attended. We always have past winners mm-hmm. there, past finalists there, and that's when we roll out what the actual procedures are.
So if you want to learn more, the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation website will have more information there. You can find out about those events in February and March coming up at St. John Fisher. And here's an email from Cindy, who is a somewhat frequent emailer of the program and a proud and strong progressive. In fact, her tagline says, "Still resisting," just to give you a little. And Cindy says, "On Gore Bell, our son landed his first post-college job at Gore Bell as an applications engineer several years ago. He has only good things to say about his employer." And that comes from Cindy. Cindy, thank you for that email. Connections at WXXI.org if you want to join the conversation about what you think it means to be an ethical business, particularly as we head into 2020. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. We're right back on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And I mentioned at the outset of the program that there's a really a national conversation, and in some ways the next few election cycles seem like they're going to be referendums on where we stand as a capitalistic society. And let me ask the board members. Dr. Ray Shady, who's a member of the board of the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation, former dean of the business school at St. John Fisher College. You know, I bet if we would have talked 10 years ago, particularly 20 years ago, and said, you know, capitalism's kind of having a reckoning, it would have sounded fringy. It's much more of a common conversation. Now, leading in the polls, if you count Biden and Warren, they are both capitalists, and Elizabeth Warren will say she proudly is, but Bernie Sanders is not. And is it a surprise that this capitalism is under the microscope in this way right now, Ray? What do you think?
I guess it's not a surprise to me that it's under the microscope, but I guess I'm still on the Elizabeth Warren side instead of the Bernie Sanders side in terms of capitalism being a part of corporate structures now. One little story that I discovered when I was teaching marketing and sales at St. John Fisher post-business career was that I could always ask a trick question on the first quiz. In every textbook I ever used at the school and have seen and reviewed, there's always a section on business ethics. And in that section, they always discuss in a very capitalistic way, and these books would be within the last 10 years, the hierarchy of a business structure. And the base of the structure is profit. The midsection, much larger, is compliance. And the top of the structure is ethics and social engagement, social outreach. And I would ask the kids in the class, what do you think is the most important part of American business today? And typically they would say either ethics or compliance, obey the law. And I said, well, the comeback, of course, is if you can't keep your doors open, to Steve's point earlier, you have to be profitable in order to give back to society, in order to take care of your employees. You can't just obey the law because, as we heard in our board meeting today, the whole compliance structure in the country is under attack, starting with the Harvard Business Review we heard. So I love the idea that ethical behavior to society and to employees and within leadership will affect the bottom line. And so the faster and bigger you grow, the more work you can do to extend positive ethical behavior.
Sure. And on the subject of keeping the lights on and staying open, PBS had a guest column, a gentleman who also writes for USA Today and among others, who wrote a piece several months ago in the middle of the summer and essentially said, hey, companies, if you can't pay people $15 an hour, you shouldn't be in business anyway. So if you're not profitable at $15 an hour for your employees, then don't be in business. We don't need you and we don't want you, and that's a bad society. Is that too strong for you, or do you think there's something there, Ray?
Well, I think there's something there. We have to, see what those limits are, but it's not, in my mind, a binary decision where we'll just flip everything to $15 an hour because it is more ethical for our people. It may not be physically possible for the company.
Okay.
So, but commit to take the steps, and I think that's doing the right thing.
Bob, is it interesting to you that there's this talk about capitalism as there is on the national level that is not as fringy as it used to be, and not fringy really at all?
No, it's, I think we are, if you look at our whole society, and that's part of the reason for the existence of RABEF, you can't turn on the news. We don't read newspapers much anymore, but you can't turn on the news these days.
Well, we do.
But where you're bombarded with situations that are absolutely outrageous in terms of integrity and ethics and, you know, the things that are done right. And our whole thesis is, you know, you don't bemoan your way into a healthy society by focusing on the people who are abusing things. We believe that by celebrating and uplifting organizations that do have the right approach and are taking these steps, that we can elevate our whole society, not just the organizations that we're highlighting. And that's the reason for our existence, is we want to be the gold standard when you look at communities and say, maybe you're in Los Angeles, and say, how can we improve the ethical backbone of our entire society in this region? We want them to say, well, you've got to go to Rochester, because in Rochester they have the idea that by highlighting appropriate behavior and highlighting the good organizations, they're encouraging more groups to do that. And that's the way to uplift the whole society, rather than just sit there and fire at all the things that are wrong, because you're going to find them. They're all over the place.
Let me grab a phone call. Jane in Rochester on the line with us. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, Evan. I want to just touch on those that support socialism and those that, and it's not the same kind of socialism as Stalin, but or capitalism versus socialism. I think for me, at least I can speak for me, my angst with capitalism is that it's so unaccountable and unrestrained. With the oxycodone things, a good example, Boeing and other companies, they pollute and they seem to feel entitled to not clean up their messes. And they get the grants, they get the subsidies, they get the tax cuts. And sometimes they come across as just pampered crybabies. They don't want to pay their taxes. So, you know, they don't want to live up to their responsibilities. They just are always scheming to try and get money. But it's the unaccountability, you know, that they have, and the lack of restraint. Thank you very much, Evan.
Jane, thank you. So Jane's touching on one of two prongs that I wanted to get to, so let's talk about that. Her concern is that, at least right now, we don't always have accountability, which is why, and again, we don't mean to delve too much into politics, but the national conversation is interesting, because Senator Warren, for example, believes that you can create accountability within a capitalistic framework, whereas Senator Sanders thinks probably not. And Jane is saying she doesn't see a whole lot of accountability, which is why, Ray, she's saying, well, that's why people are opening the door, or at least opening their minds to different systems here, because there's not as much accountability. I'll start with Ray, and I know, Steve, you want to jump in, but go ahead, Ray. What do you make of Jane's comments there?
Well, they're certainly worth examining and worth discussing, and I have no problem with her issue of abuses there. As I mentioned before, we heard this article this morning in our board meeting about the failure of compliance programs. If it's only a checkbox of programs that corporations put in place to appease the SEC, it will be just a checkbox. One of the opening sentences was that in the survey that was conducted by Ernst & Young in 2015, 42% of executive CEOs said they would violate their own compliance CODA, their programs, if it affected their financial reports. In other words, to make their numbers, they would, you know, they would just look the other way or take other steps. So there's clearly, compliance isn't what we're talking about here. We're talking about ethics, and I think that that's going to be the more proactive thing that will set companies apart.
Okay, Steve?
You mentioned earlier that there's a concept that the society is too litigious, and there's certainly argument to support that. But in the caller's comments, I had to think that when I first started practicing was shortly after the laws changed significantly to allow products that were defective to be companies that made defective products to be sued more readily and without certain requirements. And in the years that I've been practicing, we see less and less product cases, mainly because the companies have gotten so much better at building safety into their designs. And so the system can be, in other words, if you provide incentives and disincentives to do the right thing in the system, capitalism can work fine. I mean, income inequality is a big issue, and there's no question about that. But the problem I have with the alternatives is that they don't provide any solutions to that, really, in a workable way. Communism obviously failed as an economic system. So I think the even though the civil justice system is much maligned, it does provide accountability, and the opioid crisis is an example of that. You see gigantic lawsuits going on now, and some of these companies are going to go bankrupt as a result of what they've done with regard to withholding information on those products. So, I think that the caller has a good point, and that there certainly is work to be done, but the baby doesn't really have to be thrown out with the bathwater. We just have to work to find better solutions and more equitable ways to bring people on the bottom up and to minimize some of the greed at the top. But again, I think it's the only system we've got.
I want to listen to the comments from a recent program in which we had a conversation about wealth accumulation. We had a conversation that included a Raybeth board member, Andrew Brady, for example, who's the chair of the local chapter of Conscious Capitalism, talking about a piece written by an economics writer named Noah Smith, in which he points out that the traditional paths to wealth accumulation, and he's not talking about getting rich, he's talking about building equity in homes and building value and being able to send kids to college without massive debt loads and things like that. The routes are more narrow. And Jay Levine was one of our guests. He's a small business owner, 7 employees. He runs a production studio. He also does political organizing. He has organized for Bernie Sanders, among others. However, as a 50-year-old small business owner, he drew this distinction, knowing that there are caveats, and you're going to have examples that run counter. But he said, for the most part, he thinks that the political left, at least, has to figure out a way forward within a capitalistic framework, simply because, at least right now, the landscape isn't there for social democracy. Let's listen to what Jay said in the program.
For people over 35, socialism is such an automatic no, that if there's going to be a growth socialism stock, it's hard to believe that it could be in the next 15 or 20 years. I mean, it's just all the baby boomers and all of Generation X are just like, socialism, that's obviously not, whatever the answer is, it's not that. Even though there is, I think, very broad consensus and not even divisive on the political spectrum that the current system is deeply broken and incredibly unfair to almost everybody.
I might be the least age-afflicted of this panel, and let me just say, in listening to what Jay said, I'm still over the age of 35, and it's interesting when we talk about communicating with listeners on this program. Again, we are generalizing here, but there is a bifurcation there. Younger voters are more open to this. Jay saying that the older you go, and the older you go in this country, you vote more often, and your experience with that, for good or ill, is that socialism ain't going to happen. Bob, do you agree with him there?
I don't profess to try to solve the problems of the world. I do believe very firmly in what Andrew talks about with regard to conscious capitalism. I'm a member of that organization and think very highly of Andrew and the other people there. And we believe that doing business the right way is actually more profitable. It's you do better in business if you do business the right way. And so people think, oh, gosh, that's going to be expensive. You're not going to make as much money. I say I don't think that's the case. I think in the long run you do flourish when you do business the right way. And because of what David was saying about the fact that you engage everyone's full capacity.
Sure.
And that is what makes the difference. Because when you do run the business the right way and people are engaged in the business, then they perform at least twice the productivity that you get when you're in an organization that doesn't care that much. So doing business the right way has a payoff. And that's what I believe is the way to rightness.
Okay. Ray, what do you think about what Jay's saying about sort of this generational split as we talk capitalism or different systems like socialism? Do you think there's something there to it?
Well, I think there's definitely a split. And but as you said earlier, we have to look at building systems within the culture and philosophies that we have now and the best deal in town. I lived in Canada for a while, so I know a lot about social items, social medicine, and things like that. But I would rather work within the framework of capitalism here to get things done. And the way, again, to differentiate and the way to affect the bottom line is at the high end.
Question for Steve Schwartz from Farachi Lang, from a listener named Alex, who says, wanted to ask you to explain the difference between compensatory and punitive damages. Many don't understand why it would be ethical for someone to get millions for spilling hot coffee on themselves.
Okay. The famous McDonald's case, we hear
about
it a
lot. Is that a fair question?
I think it's always it's a fair question, sure. So compensatory damages are damages for the injuries that you've suffered, and that can be both physical and emotional injuries. Punitive damages are a limited form of damages which require a higher standard of proof, and they're to deter and punish the conduct. So, for instance, if a company like the opioid manufacturers, for instance, are shown to deliberately have misled doctors in with regard to how addictive these drugs are, then the jury could award punitive damages above and beyond the compensatory damages, the actual losses that have been suffered, to try to deter others in the future from that type of conduct, to make it more painful for them. Punitive damages are rarely awarded, and when they are awarded, they're not always upheld by the appellate courts. So it's a very limited application that we see in society today. But the punitive damage is limited to when there's reckless and intentional conduct that they should have known would potentially lead to injuries to people.
Okay, and so we see compensatory much more than punitive, and in the cases we do see punitive, it's going to be a higher number meant to make a point.
Yes, and the Supreme Court has actually limited that now to there has to be a ratio between the compensatory and the punitive damages. It can't be, they haven't set a definitive limit, but the general tenor of the Supreme Court decisions has been it can't be more than a factor of 10 higher for the punitive damages over the compensatory damages. So there are limits to that. But that's the concept. The concept is punitive damages are really a societal tool in the civil justice system, almost like the criminal justice system would be as a deterring factor and not to award any particular person. I just wanted to say that the McDonald's case has been very misunderstood for many years, and again, I don't argue with potential jurors on this because people have their ideas, but the proof in that case, and people are always so negative about the jury in that case, but the proof in that case was that the McDonald's coffee that they were using at the time was really horrific to drink unless it was very, very hot so that your taste buds almost couldn't taste it. So one of the witnesses actually testified that if they didn't have the temperature of the coffee that high, they would lose a lot of money, and they felt they could pay for whatever injuries occurred because of that high temperature, because their profit margin was high enough to survive that. So that's why the jury reacted so negatively to that. And I think that case got spun into a horrible tort reform argument that, you know, you spilled a cup of coffee and this person got a lot of money. But there were facts in that case that really got the jurors emotionally thinking that this company is doing this for profit and doesn't care about people. And again, that part of the story rarely gets out, but that is actually the accurate facts. And in that case, also, the appellate court cut back the award that the jury gave. So that's always the check. There's always a check and balance in the legal system, like there is in our, or supposed to be in our constitutional democracy.
I'm going to say it again, Steve. We should have attorneys on more often. We always appreciate some of the history and background, and I've really appreciated your time this hour. Steve is the managing partner of Farachi Lang, one of two recipients of the 2019 Ethi Awards, the Ethical Business Awards handed out by the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation. Thank you, and again, congratulations on that.
Thanks so much.
And our thanks and congratulations to David Pritchard and all the people of Gore Bell Inc. You heard their story, why they were nominated and chosen as one of the recipients. Send the good word over there, and we appreciate your time this hour. Thank you for being here. And the two board members from RABEF, the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation, Dr. Ray Shady. Ray, always great. Thank you very much.
Good to see you.
Bob Whipple. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Evan.
Great having you always. All right, short break. More connections coming up.